It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, Secretary of State John Kerry left Washington for Cairo this morning. We'll talk about what kind of influence the U.S. might actually have in the Middle East region. First, a new report out this month takes a detailed look at media coverage of state governments. According to the Pew Research Center, the amount of full-time reporters devoted to covering state government has dropped significantly in the last decade or so. The positions that are left may not be filled by the long-time reporters who have traditionally filled those ranks. Newspapers have been hit especially hard. Since 2003, the number of full-time State House reporters for daily newspapers has declined 35%. Less than a third of U.S. newspapers assign any kind of reporter to the state capitol at all. So, what does all this mean for our local news coverage? Is anybody stepping up to the plate to fill the gap? Joining us now is Amy Mitchell. She's Director of Journalism Research at the Pew Research Center. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Well, let's talk about the term we're working with here, state house reporters, state capitol reporters. Who qualifies and what are they tasked with doing?
So these are reporters that are sent to go physically to the state house building, to that capitol building, to report on the goings-on there. It can be legislative sessions, what's happening in terms of legislative activity, but also other activity that can occur in that building around agencies and other government offices that are housed there.
How big of a drop in full-time state house reporting jobs have we seen in the last decade or so?
Well, the comparison that we were able to do since 2003 was of newspaper reporters, as you mentioned at the opening of the segment. There hasn't actually been any full accounting of State House reporters up until now for other segments of the media. And so for us, this was really, in addition to looking at that trend in newspapers, it was also trying to get a first census of the numbers and where they're coming from in terms of the different sectors. For the cohort of newspapers that we could look at over time and compare back to some earlier research in 2003, we saw a 35% decline in full-time reporters. And that means reporters that are assigned to cover the State House throughout that year, whether the legislation is in session or not. The biggest decline occurred from 2003 to 2009 during the period of the recession when the newspapers in particular were hit really hard in terms of their budgets and their newsroom resources.
Before we get further into your findings, why is this important? Why do we need good coverage of our state capitals?
Well, you know, certainly at the state level, this is where a lot of the decision-making occurs and the laws that are and decisions that are going to affect the lives of residents in that state. That's where these kinds of things occur. It takes added weight in many cases. When you look at the gridlock in Washington, there's often now more pressure put on legislation that's occurring at the state level. If you look just at the 112th Congress, which was 2011-2012, they passed 283 bills into law. In California alone, just in 2012, they passed over 1,000 bills into law. Michigan passed 948 bills into law. About half the states passed more bills into law in 2012 alone than Congress did over that two-year period. So there's a lot that happens here. And there's questions that journalists being in the room can ask about the decisions, the conversations that are happening, the legislation at hand that otherwise may get missed if there's nobody there in that room.
If there isn't that person there in the room, what do media outlets do? Are they picking up wire services or just having somebody from their pool of reporters kind of do one-off stories?
Well, in some cases, there is wire service coverage that they can pick up and carry in their outlets, and the AP does account for a lot of that wire service coverage and activity. In addition, they may have teamed up or collaborated with another outlet, in which case, you know, we do try to give credit for those numbers that are there. But in other cases, there just may not be much coverage. They, you know, could be watching and getting the summary of decision-making or laws that got passed, writing up a summary from their desk at their news bureau, as opposed to being there as events are occurring and asking those questions that come to mind when you're following these issues day in and day out.
There have been state government reporters in the past who have literally done their job for decades and bring that kind of institutional memory. Are we losing that kind of longtime reporter who really knows the scene?
That's a lot of what we heard in the many, many interviews that we did, both with journalists, with people from these news organizations, and also from people inside the press offices or the legislative offices themselves, that that if you look over the last couple of decades, there's just this sense of loss in terms of understanding and knowledge about how these legislatures work, the kinds of questions to ask, and people that the leaders themselves know have deep knowledge about these issues and these events. One of the things that the public has indicated again and again in our survey data is that they place a very high value on the watchdog role that the media in our country play. And this, you know, clearly is a part of that, watching and asking questions. One of the other pieces of data that we were able to gather that is rather striking is that even though newspapers account for the largest portion, their numbers have declined, but now just 30% of daily papers assign any reporter. And when you look at local television, it's half as many. Only 14% of the nation's local TV stations that carry news assign even a single reporter. So there are a lot of outlets here that don't have anybody that's doing this day in and day out.
Are we seeing new non-traditional media, online in particular, filling this gap at all?
Yeah, we've certainly seen a presence, and actually when you look at the full-time reporters, non-traditional outlets account for a greater portion than do television stations. They account for 17% versus 12% for television. So they're certainly there. The Texas Tribune has one of the largest bureaus of any news organization in the country, 15 full-time and 10 students who help in the reporting that they do. There are also, in addition to nonprofits, there are commercial entities. Capital New York, which is a commercial digital-only, is the largest bureau in Albany, New York, that covers. There are ideological focused organizations as well that have gotten into the mix, something like North Carolina Policy Watch, and also many that are owned and operated by the Franklin Center, which is a more conservative operation.
So how are politicians reacting to this? Are they given an information void? Are they trying to help fill that? They and their press offices, I should say.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we certainly heard from their end a sense of frustration in the lack of coverage and you know, a longing from many that we spoke to have more journalists that were there to be able to cover what's happening. And part of what they've done in place of that, in the frustration of not having that, is to go directly, to offer direct communication. This is something that's available to many kinds of organizations now through the internet, web technologies, and app and mobile, is to go directly to individuals with your content. And we do see the legislatures themselves and the leaders taking on some of this. And in fact, when we talk with one of the people that's involved in the National Conference of State Legislatures, he spoke about how back in 2005, they used to have an annual convention where they would meet to talk about media relations. And starting in 2005, they said this group then began putting together our own newsrooms because we didn't have a lot of media relations to do because there weren't as many people that to reach out to in terms of where to go with that content. There are a couple questions that arise with this development. One is how many people actually find that information. We've seen in some of our past research that information that's posted on government websites, there aren't all that many people that know or think to go there for news and information as of yet. So it may not have the kind of reach that you would get from other traditional media. And then secondly, there's the question of the watchdog role again, of who's filtering this, who's providing the analysis or the take on the information or asking the questions about what it is that those leaders may want to put out.
We're talking with Amy Mitchell from the Pew Research Center about the changing role of the American State House reporter, the person who's at the state capitol full time, covering the legislation, the things from the governor's office all around the country. They're seeing a decline in the number of newspaper reporters and not enough in other media to really fill that gap. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's important to have a strong journalistic presence at the state capitol? What do you think we miss out on when we don't have one? And what do you think could be done to fill that gap in local coverage? Do you work in media? How do you see this playing out where you work? Are you on the other side of the fence? Are you a politician or a legislative staffer at the state capitol? Have you seen a decline in that familiar face, if not a friendly face, reporting there all the time? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Amy Mitchell from the Pew Research Center. We're looking at a new report they put out. It's called America's Shifting Statehouse Press. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about a decline in coverage of your state capital, your state government? Is there something about having a local reporter at your paper or TV station that can't be matched by a newswire or a press release? And what do you think could be done to fill the gap in local coverage of state government issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go right to a caller now with David in Egg Harbor. Hi there, David.
Hi. My comment's just I think it is incredibly important that we have detailed local coverage at the state level. And I think if we zoom in even farther and look at the local level, chances are you can know personally all of your local politicians, and when you get to the state level, there's still a decent chance that you know the people who are in the state house, if you want to, and you can be involved. And I know there's a lot of concern with the lack of weight behind an individual voice, an individual vote at the national level. And I think the more involved we are at the local level and the state level, the more of a sort of trickle-up effect there will be in terms of having a say even up to the national level. And if there's no detailed coverage of state and even local politics, I think that not only is it bad by itself, but I think it also is symptomatic of a problem, a lack of focus by the voter at those levels where they actually could have a lot of say.
David, thanks a lot. Interesting points. Amy, he's saying what you kind of alluded to earlier. Not only is state government important, it's maybe at a level where individual people can make a difference, so all the more important that they be well-informed.
Yeah, but that's absolutely a good point to make. And, you know, it's interesting. We did a study back in 2009 that looked at the Washington Press Corps, the makeup of that press corps, and there we had very, you know, consistently sourced data over three decades' time. And what we found there was fascinating. The numbers, the total number in the press corps was pretty much the same, but the makeup of that press corps had changed dramatically, and there was a very significant decline in the representation from local and newspapers and other organizations from around the country, from the state or local level. And the increase came from foreign outlets, journalists representing foreign outlets, and those representing sort of niche and specialty kind of outlets that often carry a high subscription rate and can be business expenses and reach a very narrow audience. So we certainly saw that shift occurring at the national level. And now when you look down at the state level, one of the ways that we've seen some of these news organizations trying to, you know, figure out how to do more with less, you know, how do you have this coverage in your outlet if you don't think you can support a full staffer? We've seen some organizations where they have one paper in their state. So Illinois is an example where there's a media company that has one paper in its state in Springfield do all of the state house reporting for its 11 different news outlets in that state. So they're getting that coverage, but as David mentions, it's not quite as local in terms of the vantage and the perspective that they're bringing to it for the other cities and the other metro areas in that state.
Well, do we lose something, too, if we're letting just one outlet do all the coverage? Is there something to be said for having a few different players competing for that scoop and then maybe getting us more information that way?
Yeah, absolutely. We heard that kind of comment also, that that, you know, it used to be that if you had a story and you let the legislator know, that then there were going to be, you know, five or six different outlets that were going to be putting that story out. And nowadays, this one, you know, interview person was telling us, it's one organization. You know, what difference is it really going to make? How many people are going to get that story, et cetera? So there's not the kind of weight behind it, whether it's whether they're competing to get the scoop or whether they all have the scoop and are going to make a bigger impact by having it out in more outlets.
Looking at newspapers in particular, because there you have that decade or so worth of data, is the sense here that newspapers are cutting state government reporting and putting priorities into other things, or is this just a cut along with everything else being cut at the same time?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, and it's one that I tried to, you know, sort of be clear about in the write-up of this study. It's, you know, clearly newspapers are facing tough times. Their newsroom budgets have been slashed. They're trying to figure out how they can cover the kinds of things that they used to cover in the past, how to divvy up the smaller reporting staff that they have, and it doesn't look like there's going to be any mecca of new revenue money for in the near future anyway. So, you know, some of the questions are how do you do more than less, with less? What are the different decisions that you're making inside your newsroom? So maybe you need to cut back from 4 to 3 or from 3 to 2, but you're still keeping somebody there that's assigned to that reporter, and at the same time are keeping somebody on the education beat rather than cutting that person off. So there's certainly a balance that needs to occur, but when you have 70% of the newspapers in the country that don't have anybody that's assigned to it, you know, that's worth looking at.
I wanted to get more into the role of these nonprofit groups that are doing journalism at the national level. There are things like ProPublica. Here in Wisconsin, we have the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. How big a role do you see those kind of things playing in the future when it comes to state government reporting?
Well, they've clearly, you know, nonprofits, digital onlys have really increased and taken on a significant role of news production in our country. We did a couple of different big research projects looking at the nonprofit news sector as it's evolved and developed. And, you know, we found over 400 in the country, from the very, very small to those like ProPublica and the others that are larger. One of the challenges that the smaller outlets have faced, those that are at the state or even the, you know, local level, is twofold. It's one of reach. So in many cases, they have a staff of less than 4, and they don't, you know, so they can't produce even just the quantity of coverage to try to have that audience find them, as their traditional organizations are going to be able to, are able to do. And they also have tighter budgets in many cases and are trying to figure out how they can allocate that money. One of the areas we've seen development in over the last year and a half is collaborations between nonprofits at the state and local level and also at the national level. ProPublica does a ton of this, and with legacy outlets, where the nonprofits that don't necessarily produce a whole lot of daily content but go really, really deep into the content they do produce, or do longer-term kind of reports where it's really investigative or really digging in, working with large data sets, et cetera, they're able to collaborate with a local, with a legacy outlet, whether it's a newspaper or NPR or a television station, and in a way that those legacy outlets can carry that content. And so the legacy outlets are actually serving their audience's needs by providing that content. And the nonprofit is getting a wider reach with their byline attached as well than they would have gotten if they were just, you know, only able to use their own dissemination elements.
Do you have any prescriptions now, having done this report, to get more and better news coverage coming out of our state capitals?
Well, you know, one of the things that we hoped to do was to first just put the numbers out there. We had heard anecdotally over the last several years, people talk again and again about the declines in state house reporting. So our first mission was to be able to say, here's the state of things. Here's where things are. Here's who's doing it. Here are the numbers. Now let's talk about, you know, what can news organizations can talk about, what actions they may want to take now that this is, you know, sort of has some boundaries and some lines around it in terms of knowledge of the numbers. So there are a lot of ways that news organizations today are talking with each other, again, about collaborations, about ways to be creative that they wouldn't have done even, you know, 6 years ago, because there was that sense of, you know, real competition at the local level. And now, as one longtime journalist described, you know, we're sort of now in a group hug phase where we want to all get together and figure out how we can stay afloat, you know, and keep things going. So there are creative opportunities, and, you know, there are news organizations, both new and legacy, that are taking strides in those areas.
We'll leave it there for now. Amy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Amy Mitchell. She's Director of Journalism Research at the Pew Research Center. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is off today. Coming up on Central Time, a researcher says when it comes to reading to kids, it may be especially important for dads to pick up the books. First, Secretary of State John Kerry left Washington, headed for Cairo this morning. He's going to join diplomatic efforts hoping to craft a ceasefire agreement between Hamas and Israel. Israel launched a ground invasion of Gaza last Thursday after 10 days of Hamas rocket attacks and Israeli air raids. Kerry's trip comes after President Obama expressed concern over the growing number of casualties, and Kerry himself was overheard expressing urgency about the conflict in a phone call with a top aide. But what will Kerry do once in Egypt? How much influence does the U.S. actually have over the outcome of this conflict? Here with us to answer that question is Aziz Abusara. He's Executive Director at the Center for World Religions, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University. Aziz, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you.
So with the negotiations themselves, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, has arrived in Cairo hoping to craft a ceasefire. Do you know who are the parties at the table here?
Well, the parties on the table first are the Egyptians, but the Egyptians alone won't cut it this time. So we know Hamas is in Qatar, and I think Qatar is going to be on the table, and Turkey is also perhaps is going to be involved as well. For people in Hamas, Egypt is not seen anymore as an honest broker, and so the only Arab country they seem to trust at the moment is Qatar. The last ceasefire proposal from Egypt was rejected right away from Hamas.
And does the United States have much sway over Israel right now?
I think it does, and I think Israel got to the point at the moment where ceasefire is preferred by the leaders in Israel, by Prime Minister Netanyahu. But both sides, both Hamas and Israel, are looking at this of how to not get out of this as losers and to look at their population and be able to communicate that they gained something and their goals were that they got their goals from this this war. So for Hamas, opening the Rafah border is the main thing. For Israel, is trying to communicate to the Israeli population that they destroyed the tunnels, that there will be no more rocket attacks. So both sides are trying to look like they won this battle.
Are those goals on both sides things that are likely to happen soon and end the casualties there?
Well, there is really, this is going to be more a spin probably from both sides, because neither was Israel able to destroy the rockets in Gaza, and definitely not all the tunnels. And for Hamas to get the Rafah border open is not, even if it does get open, they're not going to get what they wanted. But both sides are going to try to push for their population to believe that they got what they wanted. But that's very unlikely, and that's the trick of the negotiations going on now. And the ability of Secretary Kerry to convince the Israelis and to convince Hamas to accept a term that is kind of middle the way for both of them.
The United States considers Hamas a terrorist group. Does that mean we can't negotiate directly with Hamas?
Yes, we will not be negotiating directly with Hamas. However, we talk to Hamas indirectly. We've done that before many times through the Egyptians. We've done it before through Qatar. So it's not unusual for the U.S. to talk to Hamas, but they do it through other other groups. And these groups have always had a lot more influence. So it's even better in some ways to talk to Qatar or to Egypt than to talk to Hamas directly. But we're getting to the point of understanding that this conflict is never going to be solved by not including everybody on the table and by not looking at Hamas as a major player. And even if it is categorized as a terrorist organization, they are controlling a major part of the Palestinian territories and controlling about 2 million Palestinians in the West Bank, 1.8 million, that there is no way to move forward without talking to them.
Right now, we're just talking about a short-term ceasefire. Suppose that happens, there is a ceasefire. What next? I think probably, I won't say everyone, but a lot of people are hoping for a longer-term agreement, deal, framework, something that will make it so we're not back here in 2 or 3 or 5 years.
Right. Well, Hamas made a proposal just a couple of days ago where their starting point was a 10-year ceasefire. But even that, a 10-year ceasefire is not an end to the conflict. And if you put it into context, you have the whole issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the West Bank and Gaza, and this round of another conflict between Hamas and Israel is weakening the Palestinian Authority and really weakening the Palestinian President Abbas, who's, I think, out of everybody in this, is walking out to be the loser in this round. And it's making the possibility of negotiations and peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians much, much less likely in the near future.
Does Israel see a more viable negotiating partner in the Palestinian Authority and the Abbas government as opposed to Hamas?
No, but in recent talks, even by Prime Minister Netanyahu, just his recent talk, I think Israel at the moment is looking at more a security approach to the West Bank, a security approach to Gaza, and much less into a more comprehensive agreement. The status quo have been going on for so long that the idea of an agreement at the moment is much less urgent.
I want to get into some of the work you've been doing in recent years trying to promote peace in the region. You've had a multilingual radio show. You've guided tours trying to involve Israelis and Palestinians and then people around the world. How do you make connections between people when there's been so much violence, so much loss?
Well, even at this moment, I think what's amazing is I have so many Israeli friends who are, I'm talking to them all the time. I have some of them who are connecting with people in Gaza. On the personal level, people are tired of this conflict, and so many people are looking for something to do, are looking for a way out. And so when we come with ideas that bring people together, it's always amazing how many will jump on it and how many want to be involved. In these tours, we have Israeli and Palestinian tour guides working together every day, spending the whole day together, meeting Israelis and Palestinians, hardliners, peace activists, everyone, and they get to become really friends. And that's probably the one thing that gives me hope looking at what's happening today, is knowing that there are people who will not give up and will not lose hope that there's a way out of this conflict.
But how many steps back is there in that kind of friendship when we have this kind of outbreak of conflict as we had over the last couple of weeks?
Well, it does take us back quite a bit when you have bombings and you have people getting killed. And we argue about it, too. So the Israelis and the Palestinians in these groups will sit down together and argue about what's happening and who's right and who's wrong and all of this. But I think those personal relationships are often stronger than the politics and by propaganda set up by both sides. And it does survive. And I've watched it even in the last, as I said, a few days. I watched Israelis sending condolences to their friends in Gaza who've lost members, family members. I've watched Palestinians doing the same to Israelis. And it's incredible. And it's unfortunate that most people around the world don't know about it.
You tweeted recently about the role of demonization, one side against the other. Is that really what your effort is aiming at, trying to have people meet humans on the other side of this conflict as opposed to the demons portrayed on either side?
Absolutely. Look, my brother was killed in this conflict. I was 10 years old when that happened, and I grew up being only knowing the Palestinian side and never knowing the Israeli side until I met people on the other side when I was 18. And that, to me, was an eye-opener, learning about who they are and where they come from. If you don't know those on the other side, it's so much easier to justify hatred. It's so much easier to want them dead because you don't know them, and you start believing they're not really equally human beings just like you. You start thinking they're kind of morally less like you, ethically. They don't have the same standards. Therefore, it's okay to kill them. It's okay to hate them. By getting to know people and by getting to understand them, to understand the point of view they're coming from, even when you disagree with, it will change your mind. And so a lot of what I do is demolishing that wall that separates the two sides, that dehumanizes the two sides. And it's Israelis and Palestinians don't know anything about each other at the moment, especially the people in Gaza, who the only thing they know about Israel are the missiles falling on them and the airstrikes and the Israeli tanks. And Israelis don't know anything about Gaza except the rockets and except what they hear about the tunnels. And so you can imagine if the only thing you hear about the other side is that they want to kill you and the only thing you see is the casualties and you see hundreds of kids and women and people being killed, it's no wonder that people hate each other. And that's what we have to fight against, is that demonization.
Aziz, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Aziz Abu Sarrar. He's the executive director of the Center for World Religions, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University. This month, the American Academy of Pediatrics announced that parents should start reading to their infants. While the babies probably don't understand exactly what the words mean, the recommendation comes as an attempt to boost exposure to vocabulary starting at a really early age. Now, new research says that if parents really want to get the most out of their reading sessions, dads should do a lot of the reading because kids absorb more when their fathers apparently read to them. Lynn Vernon Fagans joins us now. She's Distinguished Professor in Applied Developmental Science and Special Education at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, okay, dads should be the one to read to the kids. Why would that make a difference?
Well, we did two studies where we had looked at both mother's and father's language. While children were, they were looking at a wordless picture book, so not reading, but going through a book with their child. And what we found was, surprisingly, that it was father's number of different words that predicted kids' later language development, and mother's language to their children was not significantly related to the kids' later language development.
Huh. So why would that be?
Well, we don't really know, but we think it's really interesting because we found it in a study of middle-class families whose children were in child care, as well as a diverse kind of rural, low-income sample, including African-American families. And we're not sure. We looked at things like whether dads, did they talk more than moms? And they didn't. Moms and dads spoke about the same number of words and so forth. So then we're really kind of speculating on what might be the possible causes. For instance, that we know from other research that dads are actually less sensitive to children's language level. So they often use language that is kind of way above children's understanding. But maybe that's good. Maybe they're challenging their children to move to a higher level of language development. So that's a possibility. The other is that we know that dads are very playful with their children and that even though dads obviously don't interact with their children quite as much as mothers, they're very playful and that children generally really engage when their dads play with them. So it might be that they just attend more when their fathers are playing or reading to them than when their mothers do.
Well, if it's that women, the moms interact in general more than the dads, then maybe the kids have heard all the words that mom is going to throw in. So yep. Giving that boost from dad is another little bonus there?
Yeah, and it can be, because we did certainly find that mothers' education is related to kids' language development, and there may be lots of other activities that mothers do with their children that are very important for their language development, like, you know, mom's structure, the kinds of friends they have, and probably chooses the child care or whatever. But it is interesting that I think, too, that, you know, in the last 30 years, dad's roles in the family have really changed. And I don't think that the society has really come to terms with the fact that dads do a lot with their children now. I mean, my son and my son-in-law are such involved fathers, and that they do a lot of child care and a lot of interacting with their children. So I just think we just need to realize that fathers make a big difference in children's lives.
Well, I'm guessing one conclusion that you're not suggesting here is that moms shouldn't read to kids anymore.
No, not at all. We know that moms are important. And, you know, in almost all the studies that have been done, of course, mothers have shown to be very important in kids' development. I just think that ours is unique because we had both mothers looking at books with their children and fathers in the same session with very similar books, and then looking at later language development. And, you know, I think it's very interesting. Someone, obviously we need to follow up on this and see if we can replicate it again. But we do have a new one that we just are about to publish, looking at school age children. And sure enough, it's the same thing, that dad's language right before kids enter school is predictive of children's vocabulary and their math constructs in kindergarten and first grade.
Well, I wonder if there are any gender-free lessons we can try to take from this, because there's not always a mom or dad around, or they're, you know, traveling for work or something. Are there lessons in our word choice that we can try to inflict on our kids, and that'll have benefits down the road? Inflict's the wrong word, I know, but maybe that's a word I should use for a kid.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that, but I think we all know that it's really important to talk to your children, and I think books just provide a wonderful context for adults to talk about experiences that they've had with their children or they're going to have with their children. And so, I can't say enough about how books kind of provide that for, you know, all kinds of adults, and why we see so much of it in childcare settings or in school where teachers read to children a lot.
And as we mentioned up front there, the American Academy of Pediatrics has issued guidelines saying, hey, yeah, vaccinations, good nutrition, all that stuff, and start reading to your baby right away. How, apart from whether mom or dad does that, how important is that early reading?
Well, I think the early reading is important because children are getting that language input. Children learn and can understand language very early before they can talk. So children before a year of age understand a surprising amount about language. And I think, again, that context of reading books helps children, you know, understand what a story's about. It allows parents to use extended language and maybe vocabulary that they wouldn't use if they're just looking at their baby and going, ooh, you're cute. It's of course also nice, but may not promote cognitive and language development as much.
So getting back into your studies now, you're looking at how reading is done early on, and then how are you measuring outcomes? What are you looking at for the kids themselves? What age, and how do you measure their vocabulary, their word choice?
Well, we use standardized measures the Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test is a popular one that just looks at children's comprehension of words of varying complexity. And then we used Woodcock-Johnson, which is a very popular and well-standardized measure of achievement. So we use very, you know, standardized measures that are administered by someone that comes into the home and does that assessment. It's very independent, of course, of the task that we videotape the mom looking at this book with her child in the same way with the father when we do it in the home setting.
So looking ahead, you mentioned the study you have that's about to be published. What is the next research? What do you want to start advancing or pinning down here?
Well, I think the next thing that we've started to do is to try and look at the kinds of words fathers use compared to the kinds of words mothers use with maybe the same kind of book. So we get a sense of our dads telling things in a different way. Are they using more complicated words? For right now, we know that they use the same number of different words. It's just that it's their, the way they do it is related to their kids' later language development, and their mother's not. So I think we're going to have to look at the kind of words that dads use.
Interesting. Well, it's fascinating stuff. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with the future research.
Oh, thank you. Well, I enjoyed being with you.
We've been talking to Lynn Vernon-Fagans. She's a professor in applied developmental science and special education over at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's studying the different ways that moms and dads read to their kids and how that pays off years down the road.